You are listening to The News Project for the week of October 21st, 2019. Brought to you by GNAT TV. This week's podcast brings you these stories. Water testing for lead wraps in our area. Tibetan monks create beauty in the Shires. Public access in the spotlight at the State House. Londonderry's turn to fight the Emerald Ash Borer. And an update on those crazy lines on Red Mountain Road.
Testing for the presence of lead in drinking water used at several local public schools was finished on Friday, October 18th, but it will be a few weeks before the results are known. Under a state law passed during the legislative session last spring, tests are required to determine if the level of lead in the water used for drinking or cooking meets a stringent state standard of 4 parts per billion. The federal EPA standard for safety is 15 parts per billion. Most bottled water has to meet a standard of about 5 parts per billion. We stopped by the Manchester Elementary Middle School last week and met up with Greg Harrington, the Bennington-Rutland Supervisory Union's operation manager, to see how the testing is done. It's a 2-part process, he said.
The whole process, on Tuesday morning, we came in at 5 o'clock, Adam and myself, and the first test that we have to take is what they call a first draw test. So we need to put the bottle under the faucet and run it without any water, losing any water. So we get the first water that comes out of the pipe. So that's our first test. So then today, we have to go back and do what they call a flush test. So we did a first draw out of both of these outlets, but we only have to do a flush test out of one of them. So the next test, we hold their hand under it. We'll let it run for 30 seconds. And once the 30 seconds is up, then we take that test. And that's pretty much it. And the whole idea is we want to know the first draw if there's lead in the fixtures, and the flush draw tells us if we could be getting lead from the pipes after we draw some water out. The lab will pick them up Monday morning here. They'll send a courier here to pick them up, and then they do the testing and will send us the results. And people keep asking me how soon that is, and I'm not sure. Mm-hmm.
The sense that such tests should be conducted grew out of data from the state's health department, which showed that in 2018, about 420 children around the state under the age of 6 had been sickened by lead, although many of those cases may have been caused by exposure to lead in homes, particularly from paint. Lead is a highly toxic substance that can cause several health issues, and younger children are particularly at risk. Following those findings, a test of Vermont schools' water found elevated levels in some of the schools, prompting lawmakers to move forward with legislation, which was only fully developed in a conference committee of state representatives and state senators. The legislation, which came to be known as Act 66, required schools and child care centers to test for lead in their water. A fund of about $3 million was set aside to help localities and school districts defray the costs of the tests. How much of that will be available to cover repairs or fixes to a school's water system, should problems be discovered, is another question, School Superintendent Jacqueline Wilson noted.
If there are any problems, we have to deal with it immediately. The state is agreeing to, are providing some financial support. My largest concern is, will it be enough? And I hope we don't get into a situation where it becomes an extra burden to the taxpayers because it has not been funded at the level it should have been funded at by the state. Under Act 66, the state said, I think it was three for a tap. If it's a water tap, they would reimburse the district up to $350 per tap. If it is a water cooler or a water fountain, or a kitchen tap, that could be as much as $1,800 that they would reimburse up to. And there was one other one, outlets for cooking. Oh, it was for $650. So what we don't know is, what will the cost be? What will we be facing in schools? Would there be another issue beyond just the tap? that's an issue of concern, which would be the responsibility of, you know, of the school district to cover those costs. So that, if you followed what was going on last year through this whole process, there was a lot of discussion and disagreement over who would hold the, who would be financially liable for any remediation that had to occur. And so the legislature got to a point where they said, we will give this much, but they would not agree to covering the full cost of remediation, which was not what, this, of course, the school districts wanted, because we've said many times to them, enough with unfunded mandates. But this could absolutely turn into one of those, and especially if we head into something, you know, we're already in a budget season, and I don't know what's going to come of that. So we'll see.
When the test results are available, they will be made public both locally and on a state website. The BRSU has stated that if any water source is found to be inadequate or not meeting the state standards, it will be taken out of service immediately until a remedy is found. About half the state schools have been tested so far. Water testing is scheduled to continue through the end of next year until all the state schools, both public and private, as well as all child care facilities, have been tested. The results will be posted on a website at the Department of Environmental Conservation. For the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. The First Congregational Church in Manchester Village was the temporary art studio for a group of Tibetan monks who spent 5 days in their community room creating a painting made of sand, or a mandala. Sand painting is an ancient Tibetan art form, and the mandalas offer several designs. The mandala is painstakingly constructed by using two metal tubes, called chakpurs, which contain the sand, which is distributed onto a pattern by rubbing them together. The vibration of the two releases the sand. Andrea Ross of Manchester Village brought the group of Tibetan monks to town and explained how the week-long event came to be.
About a year, a little over a year ago, I had the opportunity to be in a place where another troupe was here for the 2018-19 tour, and they were doing the Sen Mandala there, and I had time to really spend 5 days with them as they were doing this and got to know the leader of that group, who was the English speaker, and he proceeded to explain to me that this group comes to the United States for a year and at weekly intervals goes from town to town and city to city all over the country. And in the course of asking him where they were going next, I said, so when would you be coming to Vermont? And he kind of looked at me querulously and said, we go to New Hampshire and Massachusetts, but we've never been to Vermont. So that was a problem. And I was able to get in touch with the headquarters in Louisville, Kentucky, which is a sister monastery that basically schedules all of their tours every year, and explained to them that I lived in Manchester, Vermont, and that I thought it would be something that our community would really, really benefit from. And if they ever had an opportunity to come, I'd love to host them. And so I was called this spring, and with great excitement, they told me that there was a week in October. Would that work? And without hesitation, of course. And so I found myself just in the next 6-7 months just recognizing that the most important thing to me was really exposing as many children, as much of the youth of our community to this. It's really extraordinary that they're here. I mean, they travel all over the world. They are in major museums and universities and huge cities, and to come to our little rural town is pretty extraordinary. And I just wanted to be able to expose as many people as possible to this. And again, it is an incredible opportunity, I think, for our youth to have a door opened into conversations that we sometimes don't have about compassion and about impermanence and about letting things go. And that sand mandala is a perfect manifestation of all of that. And it inspires, I think, all of us to think about things like that and have conversation about that.
The sand is made by grinding stone along with flowers, herbs, and grains. They are colored with vegetable dyes or opaque tempura. The mandala is a formal pattern that shows the floor plan of a sacred mansion. When finished, the colored sands are swept up and carried to a nearby stream. That's done to symbolize the impermanence of life. The idea is to allow the stream to carry the healing energy of the mandala outward. The purpose of the mandala is to create a feeling of compassion among people for each other. We had a chance to talk with one of the monks while a group of three others worked on the mandala.
Sandcastle.
Yeah, they're constructing the mandala of the compassion Buddhas, and it will take to complete for at least four or five days. Yeah. Purpose of the constructing this mandala is to every one of us to generate compassionate heart towards for the benefit for all the beings. After we complete it, yeah, we have to do the deconclusion prayer, and we have to sweep it away every day. And it is the one lesson that nothing is permanent. Yeah, so beautiful it was, but it is not permanent, lasts forever. So this is to show this lesson. Yeah.
Andrew Weil of Manchester Hot Glass also gave it a try.
Well, you gotta have a really steady hand. Because I've got a lot in there. See that? So.
Can I try it?
Yeah, here, there's another.
Oh, you can do too.
A closing ceremony was held after 5 days, where the mandala was swept away. The monks will be traveling on to create another mandala as part of a larger tour. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. On Monday, October 21st, a legislative study committee that's exploring ways of ensuring long-term stability and sustainability of funding for Vermont's 25 community media centers met at the State House in Montpelier to hear more testimony about the work of the access channels, often referred to as PEG, or Public Education and Government Channels, and their financial supports going forward. The overwhelming bulk of the PEG station's operating revenue comes from what are called franchise fees, applied to consumers' cable TV bills. But between cord cutting and regulatory uncertainty at the federal level, the funding model for public access channels has been thrown into question. The Vermont Access Network, or VAN, the membership organization for the public access stations, is anticipating a steady decline of revenue from cable franchise fees, leading to a search for alternative sources of funding. The franchise fees are in effect a rental payment that cable companies have to pay for use of public property and rights of way. Against this background, the PEG Study Committee held a public hearing and heard testimony from several people, some of them industry officers, others who are users of PEG Access services, who told the seven members of the committee why PEG Access presence was important to their communities.
PEG stations provide thousands of hours of gavel-to-gavel coverage that chronicle just how decisions are being made, and my reporters even reach out to the local PEG stations to get copies of meetings they missed or to review sections of meetings that got out of hand or were confusing. And that's what is unique, that access is available to every Vermonter.
About this, we play a vital role in providing cultural coverage, historical coverage, and local issues that really impact the daily lives of our citizens. We partner with organizations in our communities, the historical societies, libraries, and schools. Several years ago, we also recognized that the cable industry is evolving, the regulatory structure may change, and we began thinking strategically about development and fundraising. And we embarked on changing the culture of our organization to support development fundraising efforts. We built a modest list of donors and underwriters. In light of the recent events, the slight loss of subscribers, the FCC ruling, and the gap accounting changes, we're exploring all options to sustain our future. We're making many operational changes to address the funding shortfalls, and we continue to develop our fundraising plans for the future. Unfortunately, after offering services free of charge for nearly 25 years, we're compelled to charge fees to our constituents for many of our services. We're reviewing our policies, we're developing fee-for-service programs for our schools and our nonprofit organizations, and we've instituted modest fees for our training programs. We've held off on purchasing new technology, and our staff will not receive cost of living increases. Despite all of these strategies, 92% of our funding is still derived from the cable subscribers. These austerity measures and modest revenue generating strategies won't be enough to sustain the organization.
Charlotte Central School. Have you ever had the opportunity to talk live with an astronaut while they are living and working in space on board the International Space Station?
It's a very rare opportunity, but 2 years ago our entire middle school had a live video conversation with astronaut Drew Bustel and Scott Tingle. and it only was able to happen thanks to the support our school received from RETN, our local community media centers.
We learned about the International Space Station and how it is used as an orbiting laboratory to help NASA learn how humans might travel to Mars and beyond. We started by researching all the different kinds of experiments that take place during a mission, and then picked one that seemed especially interesting.
The two students from Charlotte, Estelle Emmons and Charlie Taylor, talked to us afterwards about what it was like testifying before the committee.
It was pretty terrifying. Definitely not calm. It was very scary.
Dan Glanville, who represents the cable industry on the study committee, said that for the near term at least, the funding stream was likely to remain stable, and urged a wait-and-see approach.
Things that I think are worth considering in the fact that we're not at a cliff today. And I think Lauren Glenn is correct. Let's perhaps look at what the options are, but I think the reverse of that is fair, to look at what the limitations of that are too. So that I do think that there has to be perhaps a broader analysis. And as a result of not being at a cliff today, I think it would be, in my opinion, a fair recommendation of this group to explore the options and limitations so that we could perhaps regroup at a later date in 12 to 24 months to relook at that issue.
But on the federal level, there's some uncertainty about how the cable industry will interpret a ruling by the Federal Communications Commission handed down last August, which broadened the definition of how franchise fees could be calculated. Instead of being paid as a straightforward cash pass-through from the cable companies, the FCC's ruling allows the cable companies to include in-kind services, which could include the costs of maintaining channels or remote origination sites as part of the fee structure. That could have a severe impact on the financial underpinnings of PEG access stations, depending on how the cable companies interpret the ruling. Meanwhile, back at the hearing in Montpelier, the committee will work on a draft of its findings and the recommendations it will eventually make to the legislature for its consideration when it returns to Montpelier in January. Lauren Glenn Davidian, the executive director of the Burlington-based CCTV Center for Media and Democracy, and a committee member, gave us her takeaway from the hearing.
How powerful was that to hear those incredible comments in support of free speech, democracy, and public access television? As somebody that's been working in this field from the beginning, it never ceases to move me to hear from people from all over the state, from those young students, from Charlotte, and just from everyone. So that was very powerful for me, and I think that it supports the idea of the value of the importance of pay access. And we heard a few comments today about ways forward in terms of right-of-way fees. You know, all utilities, including cable and telephone, use the public rights-of-way. And those public rights-of-way are public property, state and local property. And that is the basis of the franchise fee, is because it's a kind of rental charge for the use. And I think that that needs to be expanded. But the state's hands are tied by the FCC and federal legislation. And I think the challenge for us is to look at models in other states that have found some ways around this and to see if we can apply those in Vermont.
We also talked with Senator Becca Ballant, the chairwoman of the committee, on the next steps.
And we're going to sort of tease out the threads that we heard this morning in the public hearing and try to land on some recommendations for the legislative session. And it's not clear to me where the committee is. That's why it's going to be important to poll everybody at the top of the meeting to see what were those general themes that emerged. But I'm feeling hopeful. It's not clear really how this will shake out. It could be a slight change in the universal service tax. It could be a connection fee. It could take a lot of different avenues. It also could be a straight appropriation that we could decide that this is important enough service for Vermonters that we're going to find money in the general fund.
The next meeting of the committee is set for November 6th at the State House in Montpelier. For the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.
As you all probably know, it's Emerald Ash Borer has been found in Londonderry, and we knew it would happen eventually. It's been found in about six locations around the state. So when it's been found, there's a 5-mile circle established and then a 10-mile circle established, and there's different rules that apply to moving wood out of those circles. When I get a better handle on, you know, how all that's going to work, I'll keep you posted, but that doesn't really affect the town that much. What does affect the town is that we now know we're that much closer to probably taking down a lot of trees. What I would like to throw out is that I put some thought to this. If I can get Josh up and running with a mapping program on his phone or on a tablet, and start locating ash trees and prioritizing them, and also identifying which ones he wouldn't be able to take down that we need a tree company for, because that's where the real expense is going to be. And the longer we wait, the more expensive it'll be, because the tree companies are going to get all tied up, and they're going to, even if we can get them, they're going to be a lot of money.
Yeah.
So
I guess we could use a chipper, huh?
Yeah, chipper would be a good idea. And also, the getting rid of the ash wood, I guess it doesn't really affect it too much as far as whether we cut a tree down, now that we're within a 5-mile circle, whether we cut a tree down now or, you know, 5 years from now. But once they start dying, they're harder to handle and so forth. So that would be what I would propose at this point. Probably, you know, budgeting's coming up. I really seriously think you need to think about budgeting some money for tree removal, because it's gonna start to add up. You might have noticed that there's a surcharge on Green Mountain Power's bills.
Mm-hmm.
Emerald Ash Borer surcharge. They're looking at millions and millions of dollars. And we don't know how much they're going to handle within the utility right-of-ways at this point.
Right.
You know, who's going to get stuck with it. So at this point, I think if it's within a utility right-of-way, we won't count it as a, you know, something the town's responsible for. But, you know, that may become more clear as we go on.
Do you have a number in mind for budgeting?
Well, I threw out some numbers in the past, but I think probably, I'll put some thinking to that. But as we get trees counted and cataloged, what mm-hmm. needs to be cut, that'll become more clear. But you know, when you're talking, when you're talking trees that a tree company has to do, you're talking, you know, $1,000 a tree or whatever.
Yeah.
Is GMP doing them proactively, or are they just waiting for trees to become an immediate threat or fall themselves?
Well, but some towns are starting to take down trees now. Some started 2 or 3 years ago.
Right.
The longer you wait, the harder it's going to be.
I'm thinking about GMP. Are they?
Oh, Green Mountain Power. They haven't started anything yet, but they're going to hopefully get going pretty soon.
Mm. But again, are they going to?
We're paying for it.
Are they?
They're going to. I mean, they're going to tie up tree companies. You know.
Right. But they're going to do it proactively, or just wait? They tend to just wait for things to fall.
I don't know. I hope. I think they know that to wait until things fall is. I mean, the power will be out. You know, mm-hmm. every other day. Mm-hmm. But
instead, I had a couple of thoughts about that too. One thing that I was thinking about along those lines with the town crew, I mean, we may have more of an issue just because of the fact that the road crew is already so busy right now, too, that might put more of it in a subcontractor's
mm-hmm.
playing field.
Yeah.
And another, along those same lines, I was thinking about other options. I mean, right now the main option is a tree company that does specifically, you know, top down removal, chipping, whatever. But what about on some of like maybe dirt roads or side roads or something, trying to utilize a company like that's fully mechanized, but maybe a little bit different and maybe more available for something like this.
Mm-hmm.
Like some of the equipment that like Longview has, you know, they can move right along and grab from the roadway.
Yeah, so they're, I mean, that they might not be a good example because they're not directional felling.
Right, okay, I might not have the right
company
name, but I'm just thinking
and then the,
outside the box.
I mean, the feller bunchers are 60, 70,000 pounds and on track. I couldn't see operating them, you know, on the road.
On the roadside, yeah.
But, I mean, there's all kinds of things to think about. You know, I was talking with a local trucker about it just a couple days ago. And thinking, you know, a couple guys going along with a log truck could move a lot of wood quickly, you know.
Right, and that's kind of what I was leaning towards, just a different way of thinking about doing it. And
right.
That the town crew themselves may not necessarily be able to do, but it still might be something that's... it might be beneficial to, you know, maybe more local people rather than companies that are coming far and wide with, you know, from a tree company.
Yep, I agree.
I don't know what the answer is, but maybe a different way of thinking about it, employing some different types of equipment.
I just wondering, also, I think you had mentioned that once they're infected, it takes, what, 5 years or so for them to really die. Is there any value in taking them down now from a value standpoint? It will make some money doing it?
Most roadside trees won't have high value.
Okay.
You know,
there may not be any value because we're in the circle now, too, right?
Yeah,
I mean, it depends on, you know, what, you know. There's certain times a year we can still send logs to, like, True Temper and different markets. I think mostly when it's out of the flight season, which is May to October. But I got to brush up on that. I should know it better than I do, but in any event, promoting the, you know, there's going to be a lot of wood out there, but promoting the firewood locally or kiln drying it, you know.
To be able to send
the companies that kiln dry wood, that can be shipped out.
And the value is not really in the wood, it's in the work being done to...
Yeah.
Deal with it, but it becomes a product.
Well, it's a way to get rid of it.
Right, right.
Otherwise, you're going to have a monster pile at the transfer station.
That would probably go months.
We should heat water with it and pump it around town.
So you're going to get back to us with some more information then as you get it?
Well, I would like to, with your blessings, I would like to talk to Josh about getting set up to start getting real info on. And I think he's the better guy to make a judgment, certainly as far as what he can handle. And also the priority trees. I've got some pretty good information on what we have 1,600 ash trees in the road railways, but a lot of those lean away from the road. A lot of them are, you know, maybe not a threat that we're going to deal with. So... I'd like to work with him on it.
Yeah, he'd want to prioritize the ones that are actually going to fall in the road if something happens.
Yeah. I mean, I stood with you guys the other day on Mansfield Lane. There's two trees there, tree company trees.
This is there. But there, some of them probably could just, you can cut and just fell them into the woods.
Maybe. I don't know.
Well, you go to soap every night, but.
Yeah.
I think one of the factors that we originally were talking about when we were talking about the money behind it too, the money is going to be needed, you know, starting now with those types of things. But even if there's like the overall number for all of it, if you have roughly say 5 to 10 years, you could spend the first 5 years collecting money and maybe spending part of it. And then the money for the work 10 years from now may not be generated until 5 years from now, or you know that the funding for that seems like if it's if you start now, even if the tree work doesn't start, if the saving the money part starts ahead of it.
Yeah, I think that's kind of what we agreed to was building a fund.
Yeah, well, I started out with that, and I mean, I still think that might be a good idea, but it depends on how soon we're going to start cutting. If we're going to start cutting now, then it might be a budget item, you know, year by year, too. So.
Or a combination
or both.
Of
both.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're going to talk to Josh then?
Yep.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
Red Mountain line painting, I don't think we've had anything new since the last meeting on that one. We haven't gotten anything back, have we?
So lines are blocked out.
Yeah, I saw that,
I guess, well, let me do touch on a few things as far as that whole process goes, and it's been a process. We were criticized for the way we handled it, to say the least, but you know, we've never run too straight a line.
We handled the painting.
The whole process. Yeah, this is talking about the line painting up on Red Mountain.
Wait, we were criticized?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So
we hired him, after all.
Part of the process. Part of the process was that, you know, we were going to contact the different insurance companies and see, okay, where are we? So conversation again with the owner of the company. He's denying all responsibility, okay? League of Cities and Towns, our insurance agency, contacted him, and he denied any responsibility. They obtained his certificate of insurance from his insurance company. We have that. The Town of Sunderland got a copy of that, too, and I think we got one from them, too, at the same time. Mm-hmm. So we do have their insurance agent, okay? So at this point in time, the company is just saying, no, it wasn't our fault, it's everybody else's fault, and that's where it's at. So our insurance carrier, their position is that the Town of Arlington did not do the work. So the Town of Arlington was not responsible for the damage. Therefore, they will not pay a claim on it. That's the long and short of the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And they're basing that on the fact that it was an outside contractor. It's up to that outside contractor to make any claims good or his insurance company. That's where they're at. And their suggestion was that everyone with a claim process it against their insurance carrier. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the league is not going to be involved in it because they're saying it was not their fault.
So is there more than one claim there?
That's not to say they won't not help us, but they're not going to pay. They're not going to pay. So right now we've got the one item on Red Mountain. That's the only response we've had from that situation. Okay, I had one come in today on Crow Hill. Same situation. No signs, no cones, drove over the paint, didn't know it was wet. So we've had two, I'd have to say, legitimate complaints. I mean, we had the one at the last meeting. I think we've pretty much handled that one. We're going to have to pay that. And then we'll take that and move afterwards with that. I think once we show it as an expense, then we can
pursue the claim against the company's insurance.
Their insurance company.
Right.
Whether we do that as a town or we have an attorney do it or however you want to handle that, that's kind of out there. In the discussion I had today with an Arlington resident on the Crow Hill thing, it seems to be a fairly minor problem with his car, but it's still the same issue. He had paint on the car. Told me, correct me if I'm wrong, but this one, I did say get some pictures, get an estimate, and you know we'll consider it. That's the way I left it.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically the same situation.
But maybe not a paint bomb. It more just
right.
running
it's
over
more
the wet
driving
paint.
Over the line
right.
and,
yeah.
and saying no shit.
Right.
Yep. Later on.
Yeah.
But the whole thing that, and everybody is in agreement that they did not put up signs, did not have cones. Their follow truck was too close to the other one, and nobody
didn't
knew
exist.
It. And the same issues over in Sunderland.
Yep. Yeah.
Same thing. So. That's the, as far as new, that's the only request that I've had is just from the one individual as far as...
Sounds to me like we should have the town attorney proceed with the insurance claim against their insurance.
I think
and
once...
we should stay out of it and just let the town attorney start that process.
I think once we... I think we need to get... If we're going to pay a bill, we need to pay the bill.
Yep.
And then this is what
absolutely.
We've got for claim.
Exactly. Absolutely. Then we've
got
a lot of paperwork.
We've
got
to have something... done there.
Notified
so
our insurance company
done?
Some,
okay, this one?
The one
no.
that we had last
I don't know about that.
I got to jump in here.
What the timing is on that one?
I don't know. I called and asked if they needed our tax ID number because remember they had charged tax and
right.
he said no. He didn't bother to send it. He'll just take it off. And he said he'll take care of it all. But I never heard if he finished
I don't,
the job.
I would
probably
expect we'll get a bill.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
When we get the bill, we'll know what's been done, I guess. What can you say?
I think it's important, though, down the road to get more than one estimate because I was informed by what I feel is a reputable auto body person that that paint could have been removed at a whole lot less cost. Than
off the... I think, there again, you're looking at two different things. You're looking at metal, which everybody agrees
plastic.
That it can come off of. You're
yes.
looking at plastic, which...
It soaks
the
in.
The Chevrolet garage is saying they can't get it off, not all of it.
Because of plastic, even if the
plastic
is porous.
Plastic is porous, has a rough surface.
Yep. That bill was based on paint on just plastic?
No, that was based on cleaning the metal area of the truck, cleaning it, and then replacing the plastic areas that got paint on them that they couldn't
replacing
clean.
The parts.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep. Yeah, because that's your only option.
So it wasn't just for cleaning, it
was
actually replacing parts.
Okay.
That's why it,
yeah.
that's why it added up so much in that particular case.
Right.
This one on Crow Hill doesn't seem to be, from what I've heard so far, as...
extensive.
Yep. Yeah. As much damage or whatever, however you want to relate it, as that one up on Red Mountain. Red
so
Mountain.
You're talking Crow Hill, it's just a small area of paving there. That's...
Yeah.
Yep, up to the end of the pavement.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was that recent?
Same day.
Same day.
Same day. Painted, well, I think they went to, I don't
same
know.
Same day,
where
same
went.
Crew.
Same
crew.
Crew.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Someone's had claims as well?
Yes.
I don't know about that. And there's a lot of discussion, but I don't know if anybody's made any actual claims or not.
But they had problems with the quality of the work too, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we have very... few roads that are painted, so we should probably think about that for next year, whether we even need to paint them again, right? I mean,
well,
or we have to go out
contract.
To contract for
yeah.
it and not
see
piggyback
well,
off Sunderland's contract.
Obviously, we won't use the same contractor.
Yeah, we're going to do a bad
I think
Yelp
they should
review.
Be in like the do not hire
that
list
contract.
Yeah.
Books.
Yeah, we're going to put it on the
he
Yelp.
He won't be invited
yeah.
back.
I mean, I have one of those lists of people that I don't do business with anymore.
Yeah.
They'll be blacklisted in the area because of that.
Yep.
Yeah, we can do a bad Yelp review.
Yeah.
So that's where we're at right at the moment. We're
but
waiting.
For budget purposes, it's not too early to start seeking out prices for next year for doing that.
Yeah, and as Matt said, I mean, Crow Hill, do we really need to paint that one? That's a straight shot up the blacktop there.
Yeah.
I mean,
we probably could forego.
I don't even know if you really need, I mean, Red Mountain isn't that
Red?
Wide.
Red Mountain with the curves, that's our only, that was our reason for doing that,
okay.
was
to give people a guide of where, you got to stay to the right of the
so
state.
Take their half
yeah.
out of radius and take their half out of the middle?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was just more
they
of
they still
a,
do, but.
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
More of a assistance or however you
mm-hmm.
want to put it. Does it have to be there? A 25-mile-an-hour road, you don't have to do it. But
it's just a thought, that's all.
It's never been an issue until this one time with this one crew on this one day. And
can we get some like spray cans and the little roller and have Gary just do a single line up the
middle? Leaning out the truck.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll definitely
just a thought.
Be a little more careful on that one next year.
Like Kramer, there was that.
Yeah, right.
We just need to work through this one. So that's where we're at right now. So I guess at this point in time, we've had just the two people that have said, yes, I've had that issue. If we have somebody come in 2 weeks from now, personally, I'm going to say I'm sorry.
They've had plenty of
time. There's plenty of time.
Because we've been, what, 3 weeks since
days.
The work was done?
Yeah.
So we do have to cut it off somewhere along
days.
The way.
I think 30 days is reasonable.
Okay.
Yeah, 30 days from the date.
I mean, because really if it happened, I mean, they just, if anything, a phone call, right? To,
well.
Yeah.
To start.
Well,
yeah,
if they're
I mean,
sooner, if they'll
yep.
do something. To make a claim.
Word gets around.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it clearly has.
Yeah. The first day.
Yeah. Almost immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Facebook International. Okay. So that's where we're at on that.
Thanks for listening local. For more local content, visit GNAT.tv.